Welcome. My name's Simon. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Okay. Sobriety date is June 20, 2003. I'd like to give a warm welcome to everyone to this open workshop hosted by the Primary Purpose Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Cannon on Tebe. Looking forward to hearing our speakers' stories tonight, but first let's get the meeting started with the original AA preamble. We are gathered here because we are faced with the fact that we are powerless over alcohol and unable to do anything about it without the help of a power greater than ourselves. We feel that each person's religious views, if any, are his own affair. The simple purpose of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to show what may be done to enlist the aid of a power greater than ourselves, regardless of what our individual conception of that power may be. In order to form a habit of depending upon and referring all we do to that power, we must at first apply ourselves with some diligence. By often repeating these acts, they become habitual, and the help rendered becomes natural to us. We've come to know that as alcoholics, we suffer from a serious disease for which medicine has no cure, and that only a spiritual experience may conquer. Our condition may be the result of an allergy, which makes us different from other people. It has never been permanently cured by any treatment with which we are familiar. The only relief we have to offer is absolute abstinence, the second meaning of AA. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Each member squares his debt by helping others to recover. An Alcoholics Anonymous member is an alcoholic who, through application of and adherence to the AA 12-step program, has foretorn the use of any and all alcoholic beverages in any form. The moment he takes so much as one drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other liquid containing alcohol, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to stay sober for good and for all. Not being reformers, we offer our experience only to those who want it. We have a way out upon which we can absolutely agree, on which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our program. Those who do not recover are people who will not or cannot give themselves to this simple program. Now, you may like our program, or you may not, but the simple fact remains that it works, and we believe is our only chance to recover. There is a vast amount of fun included in our AA fellowship. Some people might be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there lies a deadly earnestness and a full realisation that we must put things first, and with each of us, the first thing is the solution to our alcoholic problem. To drink is to die. Faith must work through 24 hours a day through us and in us, or we perish. In order to set our tone for this meeting, I ask that if we could all bow our heads and join in a few moments of silent prayer and meditation, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I wish to remind you that whatever is said here at this meeting expresses our own individual experiences as of today. We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are free to agree or disagree with anything that is said here tonight. In fact, it is recommended that you pay no attention to anything that cannot be reconciled, which is what is in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an open meeting, and as such, all who have an interest in alcoholism and our program of recovery are welcome. Because this is an open meeting, you need not identify yourself nor your reason for being here if you don't wish to do so. Your anonymity will be protected. We ask that you protect ours. While this is an open meeting, membership in Alcoholics Anonymous and in the Primary Purpose Group of Alcoholics Anonymous is limited to those who have a serious drinking problem and have a desire to stop drinking for good and for all. There are a number of other fellowships that deal with problems other than alcoholism. We will be happy to try to help you find the one that will meet your needs. Just two announcements. We'd like to ask all present to please turn down the volume of their mobile phones and pagers to limit disturbances to this meeting. For safety purposes, there are fire exit to the right at the back, fire exit to the left. Some of you may need it. There is a toilet at the back on the left. Our first speaker will run for about an hour and 15. We're going to have a 15-minute coffee break, and I'll introduce our second speaker. So, with that, would you please give a very, very warm welcome to our first speaker tonight, who's come all the way from Texas. Please give a very warm welcome to Chris R.
That was a nice introduction. Quick, fast, no big setup, so you'll fall miserably on your face. That was good. Thank you. I love this. Looking down on you like this. This is great. This is great. My name is Chris Raymer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And I am, you know, honored to be here. I got to thank, you know, Simon and Peter for putting up with us and arranging this. And I got to thank everybody that bought a ticket, you know, to this. It's expensive doing this. I've said it a million times. Years ago, you know, for a couple $100, you could fly anywhere and do a little talk and workshop. And now, I mean, this is expensive even for y'all. So, I mean, thanks so much for letting us come, and we appreciate it. I can't imagine living in a place like this. I mean, truly.
I used to say, why don't y'all move to Texas? I said, why in the hell would you? I mean, it's just, we have nothing there. Compared to this, this is gorgeous. We just discovered the water out here. Look, water. It's like, oh, my God.
Oh, got a chance to go to Monte Carlo this morning, drive around over there. It's we proved that the casinos there will take your $20 as fast as Vegas's will. This is pretty good. So, I don't know. I'm honored to be here. I hope this weekend we get a chance to settle once and for all who the evil twin is, so we can stop discussing that. And that means I'm going to try to be on my best behavior. I want to make sure we kind of all get on the same page. Several months ago, I was doing a talk up in North Texas, and this nice little old country girl sat down across the table from me while I was eating right before I spoke. Y'all know me. Some of y'all know me well in this room and this gathering, and I get kind of nervous before I talk. And I know it's God that's doing the blah, blah, blah. It's me standing up here fixing to get my butt kicked. So, I mean, I stand a little nervous. And so and she sits down and just looks at me, and while I'm eating, and I'm mid-fork, and she says, well, I've heard your CDs. So is everybody. So, well, I agree with most everything you say. You'll follow? Let me translate that for you. In Texas, that means, but there are a few things I don't agree with, and we're going to discuss it now. And we did, and I got a little cranky with her there for a minute. Geez. It's like Simon said, we read it in the preamble, there's no gurus in AA. We're not professionals. I want to come up here for the next couple of days, and we're going to do a little workshop tomorrow and kind of talk about sponsorship and about working the steps. And, man, we're just up here to share some thoughts with you, the way we have done the steps, maybe some mistakes we've made, some things that we do that you might be able to take pieces of and go on down the road with and be a more effective sponsor, maybe even experience happier sobriety. Oh, what a thought. One of the things that we're going to have to bring into this is a little thing called open-mindedness. It still freaks me out. I travel about 40 weekends out of the year, and that's a lot of time in airports speaking. And it's like, and we do these talks, and it's like some of you catch fire with this, and some of these people, they just, no matter what you say, they get grindy with you. They want to get irritated with you because my sponsor says this, or my counselor at treatment said this. And it's like, buddy, I'm not up here to argue with your sponsor. I'm not up here to argue with your counselor. Simon just read it. It's our really strong suggestion that if you can't reconcile it with what's in the big book, you might ought to just hold it suspect. Forget it. Worst case. Make sense? If we can have an open mind to this and maybe look at, maybe we don't have all the pieces, maybe we could learn something and just, we could all just head a little closer to the light, as it were. I'm a firm believer that sobriety was supposed to be about happiness, about some comfort inside. I know dry time, folks. I can talk to you about being dry in the program and in the fellowship and just being miserable and not a happy camper. And I, some of the stuff that I talk about comes from that. I work for a treatment center. There's a place in Hunt, Texas that I work in. I've been fortunate enough to work there for about 15 years. And it's a full service, like, big treatment center, detox, 30-day plus, where we do all the work around it, good therapy, psychiatrist, medical. It's the full meal deal. It's quite expensive, and it's a lovely place for me to work. But I get a chance to watch a lot of people get sober because of that, and I get a chance to watch a lot of people not get sober. Y'all with me? Now, I'm 7 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous myself, from about 1981 to about 1987, when I finally came back in and started doing some things a little different. So I know what it's like to be miserable in the fellowship, and I know what it's like to have people who have had the program laid out in front of them, and then for them just to walk away from it because, don't you understand, this is an individual program and I can do it any way I want, and then watch them die. I mean, I'm in a little microcosm. I get to watch people not get this every day. They die, they go to jail, they ruin families, and that's all. So sometimes if I come across a little, I don't know in the translation. If I come across a little cranky, a little irritable, restless, and discontent, it's like I'm not mad. It's like what I tried to tell this little girl. You know, it's like, but this is life and death. And this is maybe the first thing I need to talk to you about tonight. It's like tonight in my talk, you know, I'm talking to the real McCoys. And I need to tell you this. Tomorrow we got you for about 6 or 7 hours, and we're going to do a little run through with the steps and try to help clear up some stuff. But I'm there again. I'm talking to the real alcoholic and the real drug addict. Y'all follow what I'm saying? I'm not there to talk to the little disco drunk. If you can come into these rooms and stay sober in the fellowship and you're happy, joyous, and free, you with me? And you don't need God, you don't need the spiritual experience, and you dang sure don't need to work the 12 steps. Man, I am so proud of you. Rock on. How cool. I don't have a bone to pick with you at all. Unless I see you try to carry that watered down message to some poor little drunk who's the real McCoy. And then I get a little tweaky about it. Makes sense? Not going to say much. You can do it. That's the problem in our fellowships, is we've got a lot of people that have never done this work that want to talk a lot about it. And it's a little frustrating for me. And so alcoholism is a fatal progressive illness. Years ago, where's Julia in here? Years ago, we spoke in Switzerland, and there was some literature just coming out at that particular time about the genetic predisposition. And I got to tell you guys, pretty much working at this hospital, we get to see all the cutting edge stuff that comes down the pike, and pretty much the jury's in on this one. There'll be people that want to argue it, but the bottom line is the evidence is pretty much there. Alcoholism is genetic in nature. I know there's a lot of people out there that drink a lot. Because of certain other situations, your social life, your living, maybe some trauma that you're trying to get through, whatever. I mean, there's a lot of things that can exacerbate the problem and make it worse. But true alcoholism is genetic in nature. We catch this at conception. Y'all with us? And I know a lot of people want to get cranky about that. In treatment, we want to blame that on something else. But the truth of the matter is, that's pretty much what it boils down to. Myers and I... our father was an alcoholic, and is as good a man as you'd ever want to come across. But he had the genetic bullet, and he passed it on to us. I've got a little sister and a half sister that have never had a problem with alcohol. It's just we were going to buy beer for them one time. They were having a New Year's Eve party, and so we were going to go get some beer. And I says, "How much do you want us to buy?" And she says, "Oh well, I think about like one of those 12-pack things will be enough." I said, "Geez, how many people are coming to this? Is it just us or what?" I mean, it's. She says, "No, there should probably be 75, 80 people here." And it's like, what? You know, so it's like. And my little sister, that's the biggest joke forever with us. She's always the, you know, let's go have a couple of drinks. And that's what she means. Let's go have a couple of drinks. And we can't relate. We go have a couple of drinks, and that craving kicks in, and we're off to the stupid races. And so, I mean, it's genetic. We were raised in the same family, and I don't think anybody wants to argue that. But from doing this for years, guys, I've been sober 20 years, and I've been doing this from the podium for about 15. And the ones that get cranky are the ones that have been using the trauma as an excuse for their drinking forever. And they're the first ones that want to beat the line up here to come and complain about what I've said. And I'm not saying... ever that stuff didn't make it worse Because it did. Oh my gosh, some of you guys who've carried around such baggage, and I'm so excited for you, because maybe tomorrow, if you'll do what we ask you to do, you can finally let that stuff go. I'm so thrilled with the possibility of that. If you choose to continue to carry it, don't blame me. Cool with that? This will be fun. This will be fun. You can't argue with somebody's experience. I mean, I just, that's the bottom line. I'm in a little sponsorship lineage that's pretty rigid big book thumpers, and their experience, and they taught us, and we turned around and taught the guys that we sponsor. And so basically that's where we're coming from this weekend. We're just sharing some experience. And I'm going to say this going in the door, and I'm going to mention it again in the morning when we start this. I'm not a big one on semantics with the steps. You know, I think how cool this is. I don't give a rat's butt if you do a four-column fourth step or a three-column fourth step or an eight-column extended fourth step. Don't care. I care that you do it. You follow? We got people relapsing, folks, not because they did a third step prayer incorrectly. We have people relapsing because they did no third step prayer whatsoever. You follow? I don't think Bill Wilson wrote this stuff. It's the letter of the law. And we have a lot of people out there in AA land trying to split hairs. Do you do a written 10th step? It depends on how busy I am. You know, I don't know. I don't think it matters. You might think it matters. I don't. What I see is people just flat refusing to do anything that makes them the least bit uncomfortable. And the results are always the same. The thing called the spiritual malady comes back. I got a friend of mine about 6 months ago that walked out on the porch and hung himself. Tragic. I've known this guy since I moved to the Hill Country for about 15 years. He'd been in and out of the fellowship. His name was Bill W., and he was as nice an old country boy you'd ever come across. But every time he set alcohol down, the internal condition would kick his butt, and the depression would come back. Now, that could have alleviated this by simply working the 12 steps, but he always had an excuse to get around it. His was his religion. Well, I'm just going to do the church. Well, how cool. Your soul may be intact, but you're going to die of alcoholism if you don't get busy doing this work. This is a program of action, folks. We've got a thing called a fellowship, which is what we do in our meetings a lot of times, and afterwards, and eat, and coffee, and our phone numbers we exchange. And that's a wonderful part of this program. That's why I know so many of you. I know dozens of you in this room. I've met at other places. The fellowship is alive and well. We also have a thing called a program, which is the 12 steps. And that's what really, I got to tell you guys, that's what ties some of us together. It's why some of us have known each other for years, and we will know each other till the death, because we're all in that same trench actually doing the work. Each, as I'm going to say, each in our own way. Bill Wilson, up in the front in Bill's story, he says, each in our own way tried to carry this message. You'll follow? It's not like you're going to carry it my way. We have enough Chris Raymers. Thank you very much. We don't need another one. You know, We don't need another Myers-Raymer. We don't need another Julia. We put you in your own way. This thing we call God is going to use you to carry the message to somebody else. We need people that can carry it gently, and we need people that can pick up a battle axe and carry it that way too. I fall in that ladder. They can question my methods, but you'll never question my motives. My motive is absolute love. I want you to hear the message. And it was somebody pretty forceful that got in my face when I got sober, and that's the only thing that would have worked for me. A guy stopped me not long ago. I was at a place, and he says, Chris, we just need to take these people and love them until they can love themselves. And I said, buddy, that's the crap. That's the... I'm not cussing from the podium anymore, but I'm going to... That's rubbish. That's ridiculous. That's what people tried to do for me for 7 years, was love me into recovery. I'm going to love you, love you, love you, love you. You just go sit on your little butt and drink a bunch of coffee and pick, get some numbers, and you're going to be okay. No, you're not. And hugs. My wife pointed out, we got some hugs. I love hugs. Oh, my gosh. I mentioned this. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. But you guys in here, some of you guys, we got people staying away from this fellowship period because they just cannot stand being touched by other people. And yet we think it's our right to come up and, I need to hug you. I need to hug. This is the universal sign of, I don't want to hug your butt. like this. This is it. They start to walk up like this. That's it. That's it. We all know in AA, when an AA hug becomes an AA hump, it's time to back off. You ever see it? I want to be the greeter. Why? You know, it's like some old busted up guy like Peter walks in the room and everybody's, hi, welcome, welcome, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome, welcome. You get some good looking babe walk in, you know, like this. Let me give you an AA hug. Let me be the, what is that about? We need to stop that nonsense, I guarantee you. That is AA etiquette. We ought to do a workshop just on AA etiquette. I don't know. Yeah, wait a week and the hug. But get the number right off the bat. She may, I don't know. I work in this hospital, and one of the things that I focus on a lot is this thing called the spiritual malady, and we're going to talk about it a lot tomorrow. I'm an advocate for happiness in the fellowship and a sense of ease and comfort that the book promises me as a result of working the steps. One of the things I battled all of my adult life was depression. And even in sobriety, I have battled depression. And I've had to talk to a lot of people about it, and I've got some thoughts on that. The country in the United States right now, we're being inundated with medical solutions for depression. And what I want to mention to some of you guys that's going in the door here, one of my big soapboxes, is one of the first things that happened to me as a result of working the 12 steps, the obsession to drink lifted, and by the way, the depression went away. But what our solution is now, I was reading a book the other day, 227 million prescriptions of antidepressants last year. Listen, guys, the largest, most prescribed group of medications on earth, more than pain medication, is antidepressants. 26.5 million prescriptions in the United States alone of sleep medication, sleep aids. Y'all know what I'm talking about? They have that here. They have Lanesta here, the big green butterfly. Oh. And all the pharmaceutical companies say, it's not addictive. Except I've got a hospital full of people that are there because the physical allergy got triggered by it. But I'm not knocking it. You're taking sleep medication. That's your business. But I'm saying this. You're being awful risky and chancy with it. And what's taking place is we're seeing is that a lot of relapses of people that have long-term sobriety, we're starting to see come back in the fellowship. In the hospital where I worked 15 years ago, we'd have one or two people every so often that would come back in with 15 years of sobriety and lost it, 10 years of sobriety and lost it. You with us? They're mostly new people. Right now, I bet a third of our population had 5 or more years and lost it. Now, what happened? Oh, something triggered them. Rubbish. Absolute rubbish. What happened was they didn't do the work because they were staying sober one day at a time, not doing anything, and the discomfort came back, and at a certain point, they had to make a decision. I'm either going to jump off a bridge, I'm going to go out on the porch and hang myself like my friend Bill did, or I'm going to take some kind of medication to fix the problem. They don't understand that the same thing can be treated by doing the work. Make sense? We work and rework the steps in my sponsorship lineage. For some of you old geezers around here that did the steps 20 years ago, you might want to look at doing it again. Not because you're fixing to drink, but because you might get a whole heck of a lot happier. Make sense? It's amazing to me how controversial that is. Takes the breath away. Myers and I were raised down in the hill country. We were born out in West Texas, and we moved to up in the Texas hill country. I'm always almost embarrassed to say that here. I mean, dang it. It's just a bunch of little hills, they just can't compare with this. I don't know what to say, but it's a very nice place in Texas, and so a lot of people move there. And mom's a professional artist and still alive and kicking. And there was no goofy stuff in our families. We had a very nice family. We were raised on the front row of the Baptist church, I look back, we didn't have a lot of money, but I mean, I didn't know it at the time. We were never really affected by that. In high school, we started chipping a little bit. My father was again, like, would drink, and we understood. I remember a conversation we had at the breakfast table one time, and Mom was trying to explain it, that Pops had gone to his first AA meeting, and I'll never forget it. And I remember there was a period of time that he got sober, and we'd see him around a lot more, and he was just kind of available. And then I remember something happened that twisted him off, and he was off to the races again. He ended up throwing his book away, and he got drunk again, and that was the end of the deal. I knew that there was the thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also remember sitting with my brother at the place called the Mason Jar in Houston, Texas, and the bar's still there, and we were sitting there. It was on our 21st birthday, and I looked over at him, and he said, "You know, buddy, we're just getting to be a lot like Pops. You know, I don't know what to say here, but we're, you know," he says, "yeah, you know, we're going to have to really watch this. Could we have a couple more beers here, please?" And we just kept right on going, and it was like, it was my deal. We both made conscious acknowledgement of the fact that the alcohol was becoming an issue with both of us. Horrendous hangovers, compromised stuff. We were just, but we weren't going to stop. I had a budding career in the food business. I'd gotten a job at a big hotel in Houston. I was pretty exciting, and he was tending bar, for heaven's sakes, and making a lot more money than I was making. And it was, life was pretty good, and we were 21 and bulletproof. And we had a little period of time, what we would call functioning alcoholism. I can't speak for him, but for me, I had a period of time where just we weren't robbing liquor stores and going to jail and doing all the goofy stuff. We were holding it together pretty good. But it was affecting me, and it was affecting people around me. And I start to climb the little corporate ladder in the food business, and was pretty successful. I start the geographics pretty early. I start moving around as a cook. You know, it's just except you go and work someplace for a while, and then you move someplace else and move someplace. And I'm always right ahead of the gun. You know, your drinking's getting a little bit out of hand. Oh, guess what? I'm fixing to quit. And that's basically it. And I moved to Austin. I moved to Atlanta. I moved to Dallas. And I moved back to Kerrville for a while, where I grew up. And I moved back to Houston a bunch. Always loved it. Not a happy camper. Mid-70s, I see one of the owners of the restaurant that I worked at questioned me on my drinking. And he says, "I think you need to see this therapist." And I saw my first therapist in Houston, Texas, downtown Houston. And the therapist explained that my drinking was basically caused by my depression, and that if I would alleviate my depression, I would be okay. And I remember pretty excited about this. How dang, this is pretty good. And he gave me my first prescription of antidepressants, which I swallowed with alcohol. It doesn't work real well when you do that. But, I mean, I'm taking this medication, and I'm feeling better, and I'm doing pretty good. And I start having periods of sobriety, little short moments where I can set the alcohol and drugs down, drugs figured in the late 70s. But I'm not a happy camper. I'm really self-conscious, and all the internal stuff that the bedevilments in the big book talks about is eating my butt. This low self-esteem that we talk about, this feeling of uselessness. And every time I see another therapist, they give me some pills. You know, Chris, you're having a little trouble focusing. Have you ever been tested for adult attention deficit disorder? No, what's that? So, well, they actually give you basically, it's like, I'll never forget the guy. He looked around and says, basically, it's like speed. But if you're adult attention deficit, it'll help you. Well, now I'm drinking and taking antidepressants, and now I'm taking adult attention deficit medication. The speed kind of knocks off the edge there a little bit. I'm bouncing. Guys, if you can keep all this stuff kind of adjusted pretty well, it works. We call it living better chemically. That's just... There were times you overdo it and kind of knock off at dinner, and the food kind of falls out of your mouth, and it's not real. I got married in the late to my first wife to the late in the late 70s and early 80s. We moved to Denton, up closer to Myers, to be closer to them, and he's drinking like a fish. I mean, he truly, I could have gotten sober then, but he. He had such a bad influence on me that we're like buddies, and we're drinking our butts off. And I've discovered some other outside issues to take along with the medication I'm taking and the alcohol, and it's nuts. And we didn't last long as a marriage. Karen and I got in a little altercation one night, and it was just nasty. And she said, "Chris, why did this happen? What happened?" And she said, "You know it's the alcohol. You know it's the drugs. Would you stop? Well, you need to stop drinking." And I promised her that night I would, just like I'd promised some other people I would too. And again, it was one of the most graphic illustrations of some time that I said, "I'm going to stop," and meant it. Y'all with us? In treatment, there's a party line BS that says, "Well, if an alcoholic's mouth's moving, he's lying." You know, and I find that so disrespectful. I know that that's true sometimes, but there were times that I told people that I really loved and respected, bosses and employers, people that I worked with, that I was going to quit, and I was gonna, because I thought that I had the power to do that. First Step says we were powerless over alcohol. But I mean, I'm not buying any of that crap. I mean, I understand it's affecting me. But I think if I have a good enough reason, I can quit. And this was a pretty good reason. There was a nice lady, and I wanted to do the right thing, and so I stopped. And 2 weeks later, somebody asked me if I wanted a drink. And I remember the mental gymnastics I took around that drink. I remember thinking, you know what? I didn't say anything about it. What I told her is that I wasn't going to get drunk anymore. And I had a couple of beers and went over to the house, and she smelled me from the front porch. And she said, buddy, 2 weeks, it's been golden. What happened? She said, I'm not drunk. She said, I didn't say you were drunk, but my deal with you was that we weren't going to do any more alcohol and we weren't going to do any more dope. And she was done. You'll follow? A few weeks, she'd packed and moved. I mean, she was gone. That was a done deal. I moved in with Myers, which I thought was the craziest thing I ever did. And No, because Myers and his wife's here in London. I mean, they were the nicest people on earth. Thank God for family. As I've said it from a million podiums, if it hadn't been for family, I'd have been on the street. I mean, I'd spent time in Houston eating out of dumpsters, and if it hadn't been for family, I would have been back there again. This is nuts. And I'm thinking if I could just get it together, I got out of the restaurant business. I went to work for my brother. And I mean, heck, working for the family was pretty cool, you know, but it didn't stop me from drinking. And in 1987, I am crazy, and I'm working for him, and he's looking the other way. I know I'm not a great employee, and I wish I could explain. End-stage alcoholism is, so many of us don't ever get there because there's so many people stopping us from getting there. Y'all understand? There's so too many people knocking the beer out, slamming us back in treatment. So a lot of us don't ever end up doing the crazy things we do. But physically, I'm dying. I've got kidney damage and liver damage, and I am exhausted 24/7. My color's off, and I'm seeing the doctors say, Chris, you know, you're spitting up blood. You're dying of this. But I'm not, again, my external world doesn't look that bad. I'm driving an old beat-up truck, that's a given. But I mean, I'm not going to jail, and I'm not doing a lot of crazy stuff. The fact that I have a little apartment and I have a job separates me from all the other real drunks. You with it? Now, I've been in AA for 7 years. After that first wife left, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a meeting-making fool. I'll go to meetings all over North Texas. But what you guys have told me there is that I have to have at least one or two DWIs to qualify to be in your fellowship. Real alcoholics have DWIs. Real alcoholics beat their wives. Real alcoholics black out. Black out? What do you mean? Pass out? I passed out. No, no, no. Driving around. No. How do you do that? No, exactly. End-stage alcoholism, for some of us, as fast as the disease progresses, we have things called blackouts. But everybody doesn't experience that. Geez. Anyway, I'm listening to all of your stupid war stories in these meetings, and all I can do is separate myself from you. I mean, even the women are drinking more than I am. I mean, I am just not going to go there, you know? I'll call myself an alcoholic from the group, but I don't anymore believe it than the man in the moon. I'm a very misunderstood alcohol abuser. Says the counselor had given me this term. You're not an alcoholic. You are an alcoholic abuser. As he closed his DSM-3R, you know, and he said, I believe you're the symptoms you show. You're an abuser, not an alcoholic. Whoa, rock on. Sit out in the truck, you know, gung, gung, gung. Guess what he said? I'm not an alcoholic. Gung, gung. This is nuts. So anyway, I'm sitting in meetings for 7 years listening to you do two things. Listen to you try to scare me into recovery with your stupid, pathetic war stories. To this day, I can't stand to hear from. From the podium, guys, is a great place to share your war story. In a 12-step call, it's absolutely essential that you have a war story. You follow? But sitting around a meeting, why are you going to tell me how you drank again? Like, I forgot since last week? This is nuts. Nowhere in the book does it say we're supposed to remind each other every day how much we drank and how we drank it. Oh, my gosh. War stories. People misunderstand what I say this from the podium. That you said that our war stories are not important. Have never said that. I'm saying use some discernment. You're not going to ever scare anybody into recovery. You follow? You might threaten somebody and get them to go to treatment or get them to go to AA, but that's not going to stop them from drinking. If that would work, there would be a chapter in here called Into Scare. You know? There's not. So let's move on. The stupid war stories and then the little junior therapy meetings that we all over the world now, you know. Let's go to the meeting and talk about our day. Oh, yes, let's. Like hearing about your stupid grandkids one more time is going to keep me sober today. Now, I've offended all of you grandmothers. I'm sorry. Let's move on. I am going insane. 1987, fast forward. I'm working for my twin brother, and it's overcast day, and I drive home. It's a Thursday, and I went and got a 12-pack of beer and went to my apartment, picked up a stack of return checks, and went into my little apartment, and no furniture. I'm just sitting on the floor, and I'm opening these checks, and I'm just sick. I'm just so disgusted with myself, and I'm 35 years old, and I'm physically dying. I can't make any decisions. Y'all understand that? The book is great up in the doctor's opinion. It says, our problems pile up on us, and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. And that's with me. I mean, I can't decide what to have for dinner, what clothes to put on. If I had two patches, I would have been in a cul-de-sac in my bathroom trying to figure out which one to put on. Because I just can't get off dead center. And we just frustrate people in the restaurants. You know, what do you want to eat? I don't know. And I'm insane, and I'm hearing voices, and I'm not a happy camper. Myers talked to me one night. We were laughing. We were talking about something. He was talking about going and picking up a Christmas tree at Christmas time and hearing the Christmas trees talk to him. And I remember, shit, me too. Somebody understood that. I absolutely. So I probably shouldn't have told that. I'm sorry. It's too late now. But this is where it goes, and I'm sitting there on the floor, and I know I'm going to have to go the next day. Londa is my personal banker. Every time I bankrupt another checking account, she figures out how I can get unbanked. She lends me money. We get out a deal, and bless her heart. Like I said again, if it hadn't been for family, and I know I'm going to have to go to her again, and I just can't do it. It's Christmas time, and I know there's not going to be any money for gifts, and that y'all. I am done, folks. 19 years I've been drinking and drugging, telling people I'm going to stop, and I can't do it. And I've lost hope. I've done therapy, 10 years of it. Thank you very much. I know where I fit in the lineage of good child, bad child, evil. I understand all. I've done all of that. I know about my mom. I've talked about my dad. Tell me about your eye, Chris. Why? I've talked about this until the cows come home. It was a rock fight at 11. Let's move on. How did that make you feel? Half blind. Let's... What? Let's move... Oh. The endless, you know, are you gay? It's like, what? What? No. Let's talk about this. Are you sure? I mean, we're... No. No, but if it would explain my alcoholism, I would have gladly said yes. You'll follow? I've done the whole bit, guys. I've done the church, been dipped, dunked, neutered, and spayed. I've done all. I'd sat naked in sweat lodges before, which was enough. Just the visual today is enough to make me want to never take my clothes off again. It's terrible. I don't know. We were laughing the other day. I got to share it because I don't talk about it much. I even did colonics one time. This therapist, this nice girl, you'd walk into her office. Y'all know what patchouli is? Do they have the fragrance patchouli in France? Some of you are nodding your head. It's like, it's all the hippies in the United States wear it. You know, if you smell a girl that she's wearing patchouli, you know she doesn't shave under her arms. She's a hippie. That's what it is. And it says, this just freaks me out. But this with this girl, and she says, Chris, you're drinking because your system is impure. I said, you're probably right. She said, let's purify your body. I said, how are we going to do that? And she said, colonics. I said, what is that? And she explained to me what that is. Some of y'all are looking confused. I'll tell you afterwards because I'm not about to tell you now. Oh my gosh. And then we did. And she said, she set me up for an appointment and we went and did it like this. And I mean, it's like, you're going to do what with that? And she stuck in a little and turned on the water. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And she cleaned me right out. Listen, I never stopped. Peter's back there. I never stopped drinking one day, but I'm going to tell you something. My complexion did clear up. She saw me the next week. My, you're looking better. I said, I feel better. Oh my gosh. I don't know. But what do we do? What do we do to get sober? And nothing works. I'm on 7 pills a day. and I can't get sober. And I've done recovery. I've done treatment. I've taken Anabuse. I've drank on Anabuse. I've tried it all. I cannot not drink. Guys, this is alcohol. When I set booze down, I don't get better. I get worse. And about 2 weeks away from this substance, I start coming unglued at the seams. And I start picking a fight with you and everybody else around me. And my low esteem, my self-esteem drops. And I start thinking about one thing. And that's often myself. Because I can't live like that. And this is why I get very, very irritated with old geezers that sit in meetings and tell the newcomer, just don't drink and come back to meetings and everything's going to be okay. Because if they're the real McCoy, that's a lie. They're going to die. Because they will come to meetings and they will leave this alone. The one thing that treated the depression, they'll sit down. And 3 weeks later, when they get drunk or off themselves, everybody will just wring their hands. Well, I guess he just didn't want it. And then nobody ever bothered to tell him the truth. Tell him how to get well. The real alcoholic must have a spiritual experience, folks. The disco drunk doesn't need that. The real alcoholic, I don't care if you're sitting in here 30 years sober. If you had a spiritual experience, that's why you're sober. If you didn't have a spiritual experience, it's because you're not a real alcoholic to begin with. If you can stay sober on a non-spiritual basis, you're not one of us. This is what the book says. And you're welcome if you're not. But don't assume that the person sitting next to you who's dying of untreated alcoholism will be able to do it the same way. The world is full of people that are 30 years sober who have never worked a single step who are telling people they can do it the same way. Shame on them. And we're the controversial ones. I don't care how you work the steps. Work them. Seek a power greater than yourself and your life will change forever. I heard a voice that night that said, Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA. I get emails from all over the world. Chris, did you really hear a voice? No, I've just been making this up for 15 years from the podium. I don't know what to tell you. I heard a voice that was loud enough that I made myself sick and got rid of the pills. You'll follow? I heard it a couple of times that night. Don't do this. Go back to AA. And I laid down on the side of the bed and I passed out. And the next morning I woke up and I heard the voice one last time. And I went and I got cleaned up and I went to work. And at mid-morning I went and found a doctor and got some meds, some doggy downers to start detoxing. Because I'm coming unglued. This is going to be nasty. You'll follow? But I'd promised that voice that night. There was nobody in that room, guys. I'm looking around this little apartment. Where's this voice coming from? I mean, there's two stinky ferrets in there. And I'm checking them out. You know, God, I'm nuts. And the next night, I went to a meeting. People talk about 12-step calls. You know, I've worked with drunks for years and have never had anybody stay sober. I'm going to tell you something, folks. You can't second guess this. 3 years before this, there had been an old guy that had worked for Myers, and he had 12-stepped me. It was the longest 12-step call in history. And this guy would sit and have coffee with me sometimes, and he'd watch me over there trying to do something in the bookbindery. My hands would be shaking so bad, and I would just he'd laugh. He'd just laugh his butt off. He'd say, buddy, I know right where you've been. And he'd tell me some stories about him. He was in the airline business, and how his hands would be shaking so bad he couldn't be out in public, and he'd have to get something to steady his. And I can identify with this. Anyway, one night after a blackout, I called him, and I was scared. I didn't know where I was. And he came and got me, and he took me to a meeting, and he said, Chris, this is the meeting you need to go to if you decide you want to come to the fellowship. Would you like to go in now? And I said, no, I'm much too freaked out now. He took me home. 3 years later, I knew where this meeting was because he'd taken the time to take this drunk. Don't even mess with people when they're drinking. I would have died. Y'all understand that? He did exactly what he was supposed to do. He just, a drunk called him and he jumped and did what he was supposed to do. And he carried me up there. Anyway, I went to this meeting. I was going to go to a different meeting than I knew, but I was running out of time and I felt like hell. And this was pretty close to the house. And I knew I could just go for an hour and then go home and be sick and not be well. He took me to a meeting and we walked in the back door. I walked in the back door alone. This was Friday the 13th, 1987. And I walked in this back door, and sure enough, there was a room full of people just like you guys, all cleaned up, and you were all laughing. Everybody in there was laughing. This was an anomaly, because I've been in meetings where nobody laughed. But this night, everybody was laughing about something, and I knew it was me. And I started feeling real self-conscious. When y'all know what it was like when you were out there. You were just so conscious of yourself. You find yourself always watching yourself in a mirror, making sure with me. And this patch always looks like I've got an earmuff on when I'm drunk. You know, it's like as it slides crooked like that. It's kind of, women don't find it particularly attractive. Neither did the guys, I guess, but it was... I'm checking my zipper and patch it. What are they laughing at? They're happy, Joyce, and free with. They're doing and laughing. That was back in the day you could smoke. Everybody's got a bunch of cigarettes sticking out of their mouth like that. And we, as smokers, we ruined it for everybody. If we just smoked one cigarette through the meeting, we'd have been okay. But we've got to light six up all at once. Like the whole... And I walked about halfway in and says, I just can't do this. And I started to walk back out, and a little girl got between me and the door and set me down on a chair. She was about 19, 20 years old, I don't know. And she was a young girl. And if it had been a guy that had done that, you know, if Simon had come up, sit down, you know, cowboy, I'd have decked him. You know, I don't have a problem. But it was a girl. It caught me so off guard. You know, and she sit down. And this girl... I've said it from a thousand podiums. She wasn't off in some little AA land, a little young adult meeting. She was in mainstream AA doing what she was supposed to do. And she didn't care what gender I was. She knew I was busted up and needed some help. And she set me down in a chair and got me a plastic cup full of coffee, which I immediately spilled. And they got the paper towel brigade in there. And, you know, and they'd seen me up in North Texas for years. And they said, welcome back, Chris. Thanks. It's good to have you. And they went around the room that night. And everybody shared hope with me. The chairperson instructed them. She said, Chris has been here for years. He doesn't need any more war stories. We don't need to talk about your weed eater tonight. Let's talk about the miracle of coming to recovery. About what happened as a result of working the 12 steps. And they all went around and they talked about that, guys. And I got to tell you, I don't know why we can't do that in every damn meeting. I don't know why people are so insistent on using meetings for therapy sessions. I don't need therapy, thank you. I need some hope. I'm less than 24 hours away from a suicide attempt. I'm thinking real seriously about second-guessing this again and going back and drinking again. Maybe I've been making a little bit too much of this. Maybe I'll just smoke pot this time. You know, I got to get something to treat inside... They went around and talked about getting their credit cards back, folks. They talked about getting jobs. They talked about making some money. They talked about being in monogamous relationships. Yes, one lady opened her billfold and showed pictures of her ugly grandkids. But in the context, how cool was that? You with me? Because I didn't think I could even get a date, much less ever have kids. This is a pretty cool deal. There was a lady in there that was an artist, and she was talking about had just signed a lease on a little studio, you know, and I'm... I'd never been, 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, never been to a meeting like this. People make fun of this. People send emails. What, you think all meetings ought to be a pep rally? Yes, I do. They should be. They were intended to be that way from the beginning. At the end of the meeting, the old geezer asked me if I wanted a chip, and I picked up a chip. And the old guy afterwards, everybody was leaving, came up to me. He'd seen me for years, and he had glasses on like this, and he pulled them down like this. He said, Chris, I don't know what's going to be different this time. We have given you hundreds of these desire chips. I'm getting a little... He says, let me just ask you the question. He says, are you done? We're going to talk about this tomorrow in First Step stuff because I think it's important. He asked me if I was done. He didn't ask me, would you like to stay sober tomorrow? Do you think you can stay sober one day? If you can, you can stay sober the rest of your life because after all, none of that crap, because that's what it is. It starts from a commitment, folks. I live life one day at a time. Yes, I stay sober one day at a time. It starts from a commitment. Are you done? Because if you're not, go get done. The problem we have in our fellowship today is that we're picking people too green. Knock the beer out of his hand. You're coming with me. Coming to alcohol. He'll come when he's ready. Y'all understand that? Because in a few short hours, we're going to ask you to do some things that you're going to be very uncomfortable with. And if you're not done, if you don't understand what this is about, you're not going to do the work. Does that make sense, buddies? That's too harsh. I never could have gotten sober under those guys. I understand that. How many thousands of people have we killed tiptoeing around your sensitive feelings? I just need to ask that question. If anybody had approached me with that, black or white, I would have died. No, you wouldn't have. You would have drank longer and come back in and been willing to do whatever the heck we ask you to do. Are you done? And I said, yes. Would you like us to show you how to do this? Yes. And that was the nature of it. That was the beat. Afterward, they sent me home and they came. It sounded like an ice cream truck. It did. I want a fudgesicle for me. Oh, Johnny on the spot. Go get him, dog. They It turned out that night, because the next morning at 9 o'clock, they were knocking on my door, and I'd like, who is that? What's that? I'm running around looking for my patch to put on, open the door, T-shirt. Look, what's that? It was one of the guys from the group. My sponsor asked me to come pick you up. You know, they'd followed me home that night. I didn't know they were back there, that they'd followed me home. And they took me back up to a Saturday meeting. Real quick, guys, fast forward. We did the Saturday morning meeting, and afterwards we went in the back and got on our knees and did a third step prayer. They said, Chris, you got a problem with God? No, not really. Don't think I know really what it is, but I don't have a problem. Well, rock on. Let's go. And they moved on. Everybody wants to make a big deal of this God deal, and it's so not a big deal. You work the steps, you'll find out what this is about. Everybody wants to get it all figured out first. That just freaks me out. If you could figure that out, hell, who needs God? Oh, dang. If that was the case, Pamela Anderson. Could, never mind. I don't know. We went and got some food and came back, and they gave me a notebook. I'm starting to shake like a big dog and detoxing, and they gave me a little spiral notebook like Sister's got there. And he says, while you're sitting there shake, rattling, rolling, why don't you start making a list of the people you're pissed at? What? We're going to do a resentment inventory. I'm not near ready to do a four-step. Absolutely. Sure you are. Let's go. Let's get this done. And they sent me home with instructions on how to start a fourth step. You follow? Guys, I didn't get all the instructions at once. They just said, go start it. And within 2 weeks, I'd had it completely finished. And I'm sitting on the tailgate of my truck, and it dawns on me that the obsession to drink is lifted. The obsession to do those other outside issues is gone. I'm surrounded by liquor stores and 7-Elevens and stop and go. Triggers are everywhere. My dope dealer lives in the apartment complex where I live, and I don't want to use. You guys don't understand maybe sometimes what I'm saying. I found the courage to say no. No, you don't understand. The need to say no had been removed. The book says we've ceased fighting anything or anyone. We've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Those promises are 10-step promises. I'm not even close to the 10th step yet. I haven't even dumped the 5th step yet. But the miracle for me has already taken place. I'm in AA for 7 years and never, not once, did not want to use. I have stopped myself. You with me? But I've never been placed in a position of neutrality. Only after I got willing to do a few simple things. Gosh, how cool is that? Did a 5th step, an hour later did 6 and 7. Guys, the rest is history. I got sober and stayed sober. I got in the sponsorship lineage that talks about working and reworking the steps. I ended up coming to the Hill Country and spending some time there, and Patty and I got together. She was in the audience at a talk I did one time and thought I was rich and came up and started chatting me up. And soon to find out that I wasn't. But guys, we have a charmed life. We live in some little houses there down in Texas, and we both have good little jobs, and we get to travel and meet you cats I remember one very, very hot night in Houston, Texas, climbing in the one more dumpster behind a Kentucky Fried Chicken on South Post Oak, fighting a cat for my dinner. That's why I still hate cats. You'll laugh. Dark dumpster, cat. It'll scare you to death. You will hate them. You try to run over them. I guarantee it. Can't do that. Guys, coming a long way from that, of sitting in an apartment, taking 2 pills without any hesitation, 2 bottles of pills, trying to commit suicide because I just simply did not want to live anymore. And then taken to a place. Guys, the fellowship is open and roomy, and everybody's alive and welcome, and we want you, and we need you. I'm going to say this real quick and move quick. There's something about... One of the reasons that I used for not wanting to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I felt that everybody was cliquish there. I'm sure y'all hear this all the time. They're a clique over there. They're a thumper clique. They're a business clique. And they're blit. And I don't fit into the clique. See, but here's the deal. Once you survive this thing, this life, this progressive fatal illness called alcoholism, you belong to that clique. And what happens is, one of the toughest things I did when I got sober was that I had to get in and get to know some people. Y'all see me like out here, and I'm really quite shy, and I'll be off by myself sometimes. It's not that I'm pissed about anything. It's just that I run out of things to say after, hi, how are you? And it's like, unlike my wife, who, if you just decide that you want to leave and you're finished with the conversation with Patty, just turn around and walk away. I'm not being, I'm not, no. It's just, because... she's very social, and I'm not. But me coming into the fellowship, the hardest thing I did was become social again, was to become a part of the group, to sit in with the guys and visit. And that's the toughest thing I did. When you walk through this, it's why people that have had cancer and survived that always bond with other cancer survivors. It's like you walk through this nightmare together, folks. We've got a bond, and we need to stick together. I don't know. We need you in this fellowship, I think is what I'm trying to say. And we need you armed with the facts about yourself so that we can get other people armed about the facts with themselves so that we can go on and carry this message and help other people get well. Make sense? We have a job, and there's a sense of responsibility that I feel about this. And I know some of y'all are sitting on the sidelines and, I can't even help myself. How can I help somebody else? This is why you can't help yourself, and this is why you are not getting better, is because you listen to that crap. Everybody here can reach somebody at their level. That's what God does, folks. God will meet you wherever you're at, and he's not going to leave you there. He's going to pull you along. And that's our job in this fellowship, is to help everybody get connected spiritually. That's our job. And we need everybody to do that. And when somebody explained that to me, a guy named M.L. Rowland did it. And he's dead now, is the only reason I use his last name. But he was in a meeting one night. He was 30-plus years sober, and he was washing coffee cups, which I thought was odd because that's my job as the newcomer, right? And he looked around the room, and he said, Chris, we were the only ones there left in the room. People had shut the lights out, and he was washing up. And he said, Chris, I just need to tell you this, buddy. He says, we need you here. And I got to tell you, guys, nobody had needed me for a long time. Nobody had needed me for anything. The only people needed me to do was stay the hell away. And this guy's washing coffee cups, and he says, buddy, we need you in this fellowship. Because I was already, at a few months sober, in there in people's faces about this business. Let's organize this. Let's get this going. Let's get cranked. Let's be responsible. And he loved that. Here was an old 30-year geezer that was damn near dead, knew that he had a little protege on the wing, you know? And that's what we do in this fellowship. You guys that stand in the trench, you old geezers that have been carrying books, I'm going to tell you now, and I'll say it again tomorrow, thank you for sticking. For every one of you that have taken some heat from an old crusty old-timer that made fun of you because you were talking about God in the meeting, I want to tell you this. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for taking the heat. And the spiritual path, folks, is narrow. The Bible talks about it. Other spiritual doctrine talks about it. The spiritual path is not going to be easy for all of us. And we're going to take shots. And that's what the dark side wants. Shots. So that we'll back up and stop. But I'm going to tell you this. Not in 20 years have I obsessed about alcohol or drugs. Not in 20 years, guys. I've been through some tough times. I went through a lousy divorce with a little stepson. I went through the death of my father. I've been through some health problems. Not once did I want to drink. That's what a recovered alcoholic looks like, folks. And we all need to start introducing ourselves from the podium as that, because that's what the book tells us to do. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I am honored to be here. Thank you so much for letting me come.